This is Andrew Cate.
And this is Ryan Capuano, and welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Charlize Theron does her best John Wick impression with Atomic Blonde, while Casey Affleck dons a bedsheet for David Lowery's A Ghost Story.
We're going to kick things off with our thoughts on Atomic Blonde. And while I'm not entirely sure I completely understood what was happening throughout much of this movie, I will say, overall, I liked it, although with certainly more than a few reservations. I think there's some strikingly colorful cinematography. There's some really inventive, obviously, stunt work, because this is directed by David Leitch, if that's how you say his, if that's how you pronounce his name, who served as the uncredited co-director of the first John Wick film and has made a career out of doing the stunt coordination for a lot of films. And that's why the John Wick films and this film in particular have some pretty inventive action choreography and stunt work. Ryan, your initial thoughts on Atomic Blonde?
It's kind of hard to know what to make of this film because it's almost fucking impossible to tell what the plot is. I think the whole thing is kind of set against this this backdrop of, I guess like the post-mortem debriefing at MI6 headquarters with the CIA officer played by John Goodman and Toby Jones as the MI6 officer. It's just, I'll start by doing something I don't normally do, and that's compliment a film I did not like. And I think it's a godsend in the sense that the action scenes in this film are not only very, technically impressive, but you can actually see what the hell is going on in them. Like, it actually looks and feels like a real fight. Trumped up sound mix aside, this actually feels a little bit more grounded in reality with its violence, which I think is most certainly its strongest asset. Having said that, this film is a complete unholy mess, and I like, there's something about Charlize Theron's significant other, who is also like an undercover spy, getting assassinated because he has a list of all these other undercover operatives, and if they're exposed, then the Cold War will end. And I feel like the whole thing that will end badly, and I feel the whole thing was set against the backdrop of the Berlin Wall, just because they wanted to use a bunch of new wave songs for the soundtrack, and it's a little jarring at times. And you mentioned a few on the nose choices itself, but I really this movie was so unbearably boring at times too, just because of how convoluted a mess it was, and I can't get past that. And unfortunately, the action scenes came a little too late for me to redeem the film, but in their own right, I guess they were enjoyable.
Yeah, and I think the one sequence that a lot of people are talking about, and the one sequence that is sort of stand out from this film, is the staircase sequence where Charlize Theron's character is protecting Eddie Marsan's character, whoever he is. There's a lot of spy mumbo jumbo in this film, so you just sort of have to go with it and enjoy it without thinking about it too hard. But I think that sequence in particular, it was obviously done in a long take, although I definitely feel like watching it, there was probably some shortcuts just because there were some actors like moving very close to the camera, and usually when they pass the camera very closely, that is to hide sort of an invisible cut. But I thought that sequence in particular was definitely the standout sequence in the film. You mentioned briefly sort of the framing device of this film, and I have to say, I'm not a particular big fan of framing devices, and I feel like this framing device, I didn't really understand the purpose of it until, like, the end where they use it for, like, some twist that I'm not even entirely sure makes complete sense. But, you know, unlike Ryan, like, I did overall enjoy the film, and I think it was just because I thought Charlize Theron, I can't really imagine another actress like doing what she does in this film, where she has this, I don't know what it is, like, I don't know if it's this movie star charisma or something, where she just has this presence on screen. And there's lots of shots, and I've seen a few different critics mention this, there's lots of striking close-ups of her, and you really feel her presence off the screen. And I think some of the sort of neon infused cinematography adds to that as well. But like I said, I enjoyed it overall, but that's with, I feel like this film has definitely a number of flaws. And you mentioned the music choices, and this film's composer is Tyler Bates. Some of you may know him as the man behind the music composition and the soundtracks of films like Guardians of the Galaxy, and a few of Zack Snyder's films. So you can certainly tell that he's sort of hit and miss in some of the Zack Snyder films. I feel like some of his music choices were pretty on the nose, particularly in Watchmen. There's a few. In this film, for me, and there was some songs that worked, trying to give it that 80s, you know, feel or whatever. And then there were some films, particularly towards the end, that really felt like on the nose, like using London Calling and all this stuff. It was just like, oh, gee, I haven't heard that song in a movie a million times over. And it just felt like the movie was so obsessed with the 80s time period that they just decided to go with it rather than, you know, and just sort of throw those songs in to add flavor to it, when I think better choices would have been to just not have music over those particular scenes.
I agree. It just kind of stands out as self-indulgence more than anything. And I, you know, back to the point about Charlize Theron is that, yeah, she's one of my favorite actresses. I just think she can do no wrong as a performer, regardless of her questionable project choices sometimes. But I also feel like, you know, a lot of hubbub was made about this film being, you know, the female action star, you know, set the reinvention or whatever. But this film is very much still in the realm of, it's written by a man and directed by a man, and there's a gratuitous lesbian sex scene in there that really sticks out like a sore thumb. I give kudos to the fact that the physics of the film feel like this is how a woman would use her physicality versus a man. So I think that part is strong, but I just think there's a little bit too much, you know, typical action film bravado that kind of holds it back from being, you know, that feminist be-all end-all that a couple people have made it out to be. Maybe that's an unfair point to pick on, but it was just something that stuck out in the back of my mind.
Yeah, and we also have to mention, obviously, James McAvoy, who plays this sort of other spy in this film. And, I mean, I will give credit where credit's due, is he's much better at playing sort of sleazeball characters than I expect. Although, as I'm sure many of you can imagine, when you go into a spy-centric film or special agent-centric film, whatever it is, you can usually predict if there's two lead actors in a film, and maybe this is getting into a bit spoilerish territory, so I'm just going to mention that quickly, but like, I feel like it's so predictable in a film like this where, oh, there's two major lead actors, one of them is going to end up having nefarious purposes or whatever, and I'm sure you can imagine what I'm getting at here. I mean, I'll give credit where credit's due, where, I mean, I don't know, I'm always surprised that he is so good at playing these sort of, I don't know how to describe it, sort of vile characters, so credit where credit's due, but I thought it was a bit predictable in that sense, where his character goes. Although I did want to mention, although some of the editing in this film I feel is a bit off, I did want to give a quick shout out to some of the editing in sort of their climactic sequence between McAvoy and Theron, where they sort of did this sort of clever thing where they were, they sort of started the scene before you even knew it started with shots of James McAvoy, and you weren't entirely sure what was happening, and then it sort of flowed into the scene. So I feel like some of the editing didn't work in that particular case. I thought it was pretty inventive for the film, so that worked for me. But, I mean, overall, it just sort of, the movie is a bit messy for my taste, although overall I did end up enjoying it. And I guess we have to talk a little bit about the ending, because it's just, I mean, it's just a bit baffling. Like, it almost felt like there was too many endings. Like, it felt like, oh, the film's gonna end here, and then there's another scene and another scene. They were trying to wrap it up cleanly, and then had a twist at the end that I'm not even entirely sure I completely understood what they were going for with the John Goodman character. I think I get what they were trying to do, but I'm not sure it works in the context. It feels like, oh, this seems like the thing to do, so we're going to tack this on at the end. And I also just wanted to mention that, you know, this film is being sort of advertised and talked about as sort of the female John Wick. And although Charlize Theron is a great presence in this film, I feel like the film doesn't even capture the energy of either of those two films. So,
Yeah, that ending is pretty, like I said, the whole thing is really borderline impossible to follow, and even with Charlize Theron kind of narrating what's going on over it, it really just makes absolutely no sense, and it feels like they kind of tack the ending on because, I don't know if you've ever had this phenomenon in your life wherein everyone kind of, you're a movie guy, and then people say, oh, well, did you see this movie had a great ending? This is the kind of movie that feels like it would fall into that ballpark, and it's just, and then you try to like break it down as to why just because you were surprised by it doesn't necessarily mean that it was a good thing. I can usually pick out a movie's ending, around the 30-minute mark. With this one, there's really literally no way you can even see where the hell this is going to go, because it makes absolutely no sense. This would honestly it would have been a neater ending if John Goodman just, I don't know. I can't say anything without getting like too spoilery, but you know.
I mean, I feel like I'm just going to give a spoiler alert right now because I feel like we have to talk about this, you know, just to try and make sense of it. Yeah. So just a warning, you know, skip ahead a few minutes if you want to avoid this. But so basically it ends at the scene on a plane, right, where John Goodman, he's playing this CIA American guy who's in this framing device where basically, so we have Toby Jones as like the British operative and John Goodman as the American operative. And basically they're interviewing Charlize Theron. And that's the framing device for this film where, you know, it jumps back. Oh, we see how she got to this point, and then we see where it goes from there afterwards. And the ending is so confusing because, like I said, like it feels like the framing device is only there for this twist at the end. And basically it's like this twist where it's like, I guess she was working for the CIA and John Goodman. And I'm a little confused as to whether, is she actually British or is she American playing British? Because she has like she has very little dialogue in that last scene where I wasn't paying attention close enough to hear exactly, is she speaking British? Is she an American just playing British? Like, I don't know what your thoughts on this, but...
It's the way I interpreted it is that Charlize Theron was an American operative pretending to be British, which is just about the most nonsensical fucking thing I've ever heard in my entire life. So, I mean, never mind the fact that MI6 somehow did not pick up on any of this. Even in the Cold War era in the late 80s, they still had some pretty good spy mechanics. So I think this would have been blown up long before, especially since they make it a point to say that, you know, oh, well, the second she landed in Russia, everyone fucking knew who she was. And it's crap. It's something that it's like the fleece being pulled over your eyes just so... I don't know. The whole thing, it just leaves me with such a sour taste in the mouth. And even, you know, good action scenes aside, I just, like, it bugged the living shit out of me.
Yeah, like you said, there's no way to predict this is where the movie is going. It feels tacked on in that way where it doesn't build up to this. It's just sort of there, and it feels like, and that's why, like, the convoluted nature of the plot. Like, there definitely is a section of the audience that is going to enjoy this film just because, you know, you can, if you turn your brain off and just enjoy it for what it is and look at the visuals, there's some striking imagery. As I mentioned, there's some inventive action sequences, really, as you said, really clear fight choreography that definitely adds to the overall experience. So really, to enjoy this film overall, I think you just have to sort of turn your brain off a little bit, not think too hard about what they're trying to do with the plot, and just sort of enjoy the action and Charlize Theron being a badass. And I guess that's why overall I like it, although with a lot of reservations.
As someone who overthinks everything, this movie was not for me.
And with that said, I guess we'll move on to a ghost story, Ryan.
Yeah, there really wasn't much news, so jumping right into, honestly, one of the most depressing movies I've ever seen in my entire life. But, you know, I've stated a few times over the course of this podcast that this was pretty much my most anticipated film of the summer. I was a big fan of Ain't Them Body Saints as well. I think that Lowery is just a very special filmmaker, and it's not something you can really pigeonhole in one style or another, but he just tries things that feel... It's like a very naturalistic style of filmmaking. I think the most, you know, striking thing that people first notice about a ghost story, aside from Casey Affleck, you know, dressing like a Charlie Brown ghost, is that it's shot in like the full frame, like the old the 1.33:1 aspect ratio that you most see in, like, you know, the full screen old CRT televisions. And that's really, it might feel kind of like an affectation at times, but it really, as the themes of the film kind of unravel, it really shows that it's used for thematic purposes. And the frame isn't exactly like a flush frame either. It looks like a film frame that would be passing through a camera, which I think kind of lends, you know, to that, you know, the idea of memory, the memories of a person after they're gone. Basically, the film is Casey Affleck is in a relationship with Rooney Mara. They just move into this house, and then he is killed in a car accident. And so for most of the film, he's just kind of wandering around after his death as a ghost and seeing the progression of how his this home changes over time and how, you know, the how it affected Rooney Mara. And I think the most striking thing is how this film just really pulls you into that grief. There's like a, it feels like a 30-minute scene of Rooney Mara just sitting on the floor eating a pie. And it's one of the most devastating things I've ever witnessed. This is just a phenomenal film. This is easily the best thing I've seen all year. I don't think it's even close. Lost City of Z aside, there's nothing that even touches it as far as I'm concerned.
It's definitely up there for me, and it's hard to say where it ranks right now, but I definitely love this film as well. And what I admire about it so much is it's a really seemingly simple concept, but it's really clever as well. And, you know, and it really got me really emotional throughout. And, you know, what I love about this film is it's like, oh, you know, this is what you'd like to imagine ghosts go through after. Although, saying that, it's really depressing existence. But, I don't know, I really loved this scene. I really loved the simple touch where the ghosts were interacting. I thought that was really great and really clever, a really clever way to do it. You mentioned that pie scene. You know, the way I mentioned, you know, people were talking about Atomic Blonde for that staircase scene. People were talking about A Ghost Story for that pie scene. You know, this film is very slow-paced, and that scene in particular where basically you said it's very naturalistic. A lot of these shots, basically, there's like one shot of Rooney Mara eating this pie on the floor, and we just stay on her for what seems like an interminable amount of time, and that's the point of the scene. Dear Lowry wants you to feel this grief as she eats the pie, and we see the ghost off in the background. It's just really effective emotional stuff in this film. Throughout that, I think it's just really effective stuff, and like I just think it's such a ballsy idea for a film to do. As I said, really, it's seemingly simple concept on the surface, but something I'm jealous that I didn't think of, you know, as a filmmaker. Like, it's like, oh, it's such a simple thing to do, show the life of a ghost. And, you know, I remember a lot of the trailers for this film. They talked about this is really like a meditation on time. There's a quote on there, and I was like, I couldn't agree more. This is like it doesn't, like, try to over-explain things. It's just a really simple way of showing the life of a ghost and how there's even some sort of, I don't know if I'd call them time travel elements, but it's just sort of really, it's done in such a simple way that you don't question it and that you buy into the film emotionally on every level.
Absolutely. And I think there's such a great, well, first of all, I want to mention that scene that, you know, with the ghost across the, in the other house across the way is honestly when, so basically Casey Affleck sees another ghost in another house, and they kind of communicate via subtitles and simple gestures, and it's all like, you know, very simplistic dialogue, like hello, hi. But the other ghost says, I'm waiting for someone, and Casey Affleck asks who, and the ghost across the way pauses for a second and then goes, I don't remember. And it just, like, that was a part, I don't know why, but that devastated me. I sat in the front row at the cable car purposely just because I know I was going to cry and I didn't want other people in the theater to see me. But that scene just got to me. And I think Lowry just makes, even with the smaller frame, I think there's just such a great sense of space in this film. I mean, he really captures that warmth that you feel in from this house. And I think there's such a great use of the sound design. There are, like, these really, you know, he emphasizes the right sound effects at the right time, and there's such a great, you know, atmosphere in the background. It really gives you that lived-in feel. I guess that's the best way I can describe it.
Yeah, and what's so great about this film, not only is there really striking visuals, you know, but you completely buy into, like, it seems like such a goofy decision to just have, oh, this great actor like Casey Affleck, oh, he's just going to wear a white bedsheet for this entire film or whatever, for most of the entire film or whatever. I shouldn't say all of it. But, like, there's some really, like, in the hands of another filmmaker, it might feel cheesy or you might, like, giggle at the sight of this. But just based on how the film is crafted and how each frame is really carefully attended to, you totally buy into it. And the imagery really affects you emotionally rather than having that effect. And I did want to pose a question to you. It may feel a little jokey for a film of this nature, but it's something that struck me where, you know, essentially over the course of this film, we see Casey Affleck's ghost experience, you know, as different families or groups of people move into the house. And it's really interesting because there's this great scene where this new family moves into the house and he sort of scares them off by throwing shit around. You know, it's sort of like seeing a different perspective on that sort of classic horror scene. And I thought it was really clever. Although I'm not entirely sure why he did this to this loving family and not to that weird monologuing guy. it just felt weird to me that, he's scaring off, you know, I don't know if he was feeling something at the time. He's scaring off this nice Hispanic family. And then, you know, there's this weirdo monologuing guy that we stay on for this one shot. And Casey Affleck just lets him go on. And I'm just like, man, what are you doing, man? Like, I don't know. It may feel a bit tongue-in-cheek for this film, but I just had to mention that because it struck me as something.
I guess because the guy in overalls who looked like Bonnie Prince Billy was probably second to live in the house after that. Maybe it's just because that grief was so fresh with some new family in the house. That's about the best I could come up with. And I will say that monologue guy is really the only outlier. And not necessarily that's a bad thing because I still think it works and fits.
Yeah.
But it's just like this guy comes up with the shit that I've been thinking about since I was 12 years old. There's nothing revelatory to me, so it kind of fell on deaf ears to me. I think other people who don't necessarily have my cheery outlook on life might react slightly differently to it, but that's the best answer I can give to that one.
Yeah, I know, I just had to mention that. It was a weird thing to mention, but it's just a note I wrote down that just struck me when watching the film. But I also thought, I don't know, it was just seeing that other perspective, like a story like this would usually be told from a horror perspective or whatever, but this is really told from an emotional grief perspective. And I thought it was really clever how the film sort of loops around where we follow after, you know, Rooney Mara moves out of the house and we follow this ghost and stay in the house. And then eventually, I mean, I'm not going to spoil how it happens, but essentially we loop around and the ghost is able to witness, you know, in case they have like in Rooney Mara's relationship, he's able to witness his own relationship and see it up close. And there's also this little plot point where basically Rooney Mara writes this note and leaves it in the house after she leaves. And we never ever really learn exactly, you know, what she wrote on this note, but we understand the purpose of it, you know. And it, I don't know, it's just a really great meditation on time, on grief, and how we deal with it and how we learn to let things go. And I, what I love about this film is it doesn't over-explain everything. It just, you know, presents it to you and gets you emotionally invested. And really, I mean, that's all you can ask for from a film, in my opinion.
Yeah, it doesn't beat you over the head with explanation, but I also found it to be a very easy film to follow. I think sometimes in these, we'll just call it the broad category of the Malick-esque films, I think they kind of get lost in their own philosophy, but I think Lowry is much more economical than that. This is a story told front to back, and primarily through visuals. There's not a hell of a lot of dialogue aside from Bonnie Prince Billy's scene, but it really just, it digs under the skin in a way, and it's a very brief film. It's 90 minutes, but it's 90 minutes of just like having a lump in your throat the entire time. And the way it ends, it's not, I mean, you know, a friend of mine asked me if it had what she would call a happy ending. I don't necessarily think it's a happy ending, but I think it gives you closure, and I think it's a positive, not happy, but a positive ending.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's sort of like, you know, you understand what the ghost has been through, and at the point where they find some sort of closure on this relationship and on this house or whatever. And I don't know. It's really hard to say much more about the film, just because other than, you know, it really emotionally affected me, unlike any other film this year or whatever. And that's why it's definitely one of my favorite films of the year. And it's great to see, you know, a filmmaker the quality of David Lowry continuing his collaborations with these great actors like Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck. And I think it's just a ballsy decision to put an actor of his quality under a bedsheet for a long running time, and credit to him, because I believe it's him throughout the entire film, even though you could have gotten away with another actor clearly wearing this bedsheet.
I know. This is, like I said, this is the best film of the year. It is in pretty much limited release right now. My guess is it won't take too long before it gets to video on demand. Usually those come out pretty quick in like September or October. I highly, highly, highly recommend you go out of your way and watch this film. Just fair warning, this is my wheelhouse, and that's really the best I can say.
This is definitely not a film for everyone. You have to have sort of a specific, I guess, filmic sensibility or whatever. But I think this film can be appreciated if you go in with an open mind and just expect, you know, this sort of slow-paced meditation on grief.
And the palpable sense of grief.
Oh, totally, totally. And with that in mind, I guess we'll finish up this episode and let you know that next week we'll be covering The Dark Tower, which is being raked over the coals by the film critics, and we'll also be discussing Catherine Bigelow's Detroit.
I am very much looking forward to Detroit, but we will get into that next week, and I'll probably get a little political. I'm sorry, Andrew. Thank you for listening.